Obama's New Imperialism. I'll introduce people and chair the session. My name's Ashley Smith. I am part of the United National Anti-War Coalition and also a member of the Coalition Against NATO G8, the coalition that came together to help with Occupy organize the People's Summit and also put on the big demonstration that you've heard about all weekend on May 20th that I hope everybody will help build and turn out to. And then after I speak, Colonel Ann Wright, who needs no introduction, I'm sure everybody has heard her speak and I've heard of her before, and Soraya Sahar will be our last speaker, and I'm sure people heard her very moving reading of Malalai Joya's statement to the People's Summit. Soraya is a leader, member of Afghans for Peace in Toronto, Canada. So I will just kick it off. We're going to do is each of us will speak for 10, 12 minutes, and then we'll open it up to question and discussions. Anne is going to have to leave for a little bit to pop into another thing, give a little talk, and then sprint back, and we'll be back to answer and address any questions or that comes up in the discussion. So we'll just speak in turn, and then we'll throw it to the audience, and I'll keep a stack of people who want to get on the speakers list. So what I'm going to do is give an introduction about Obama's new imperialism that's based on an article that, if people are interested in, is in the new issue of the International Socialist Review that goes into more detail about what Obama's introduced in his new defense guidance, which is his so-called pivot to Asia, which is a major recalibration of U.S. imperial strategy, not only in Asia, but actually the whole world, the Middle East, and Asia in particular. And it'll come as no surprise to people at this conference that Obama's not a peace president. I don't know if anybody missed the memo on that, but Obama's not a peace president. I think there's no better indication that he's not a peace president than when he got the Nobel Peace Prize and proceeded to give a speech justifying war. When he got the Nobel, I mean, this is Orwellian to the nth degree. And in reality, what Obama's really done in his first 4 years in office is continue the second term of the Bush administration, the bailouts for the financial system, and then really pursuing and finalizing plans for the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan. But those strategies really haven't borne fruit, as I'll talk about, and so he has decided on a major reorientation of U.S. imperial strategy. But to figure out where Obama's change comes from, you have to understand the nightmare that went before Obama, which is the unforgettable and hopefully forgettable in historical terms, George Bush administration. Bush came to power really at the apogee of American imperial power after the Cold War. The biggest economy was the United States, the biggest military force was the United States, and Bush hoped to lock in a unipolar world order under U.S. domination. So if the Cold War was a bipolar world order between Russia and the United States, he wanted to lock in militarily a unipolar world order by securing U.S. control of Middle Eastern oil reserves to prevent any other power having independent access to those oil reserves, including the people of the Middle East and their governments controlling those oil reserves. And 9/11 was his opportunity, made in heaven, really, to implement that strategy. So he went to war very quickly in Iraq, in Afghanistan first, and then in Iraq, as we all know. But like everything with Bush, he had the reverse Midas touch. Everything he touched turned to lead, not gold. And so if you look at what Bush's term in office, it was a disaster for Americans, obviously, but it was an absolute catastrophe for the people in Afghanistan and Iraq. And what he underestimated is nobody likes to be occupied. And so the people of Afghanistan and the people of Iraq resisted the occupations of their country, and as a result, the Bush administration turned to a massive campaign of neocolonial counterinsurgency warfare, the repression of the people that it was supposed to be liberating. And so his imperial interventions were a disaster. And then on top of that, he oversaw the biggest economic crisis since the Great Depression. And both of these things have undermined American military, economic, and political might all around the world. And while the U.S. was bogged down in this twin crisis of economic power and imperial power, new powers began to rise to challenge U.S. dominance in the world system, principally China, but many others. Russia, India, Brazil, regional powers who are getting out of the lockbox of U.S. imperial domination. So the attempt to enforce a unipolar world order backfired, and we have an emergent multipolar world order in which there's a main rival, China, and other rising powers. So the U.S. ruling class turned to Barack Obama to save the mess. That's why the financial industry bankrolled the Obama administration, and that's why lots of the military establishment actually went over to the Obama administration campaign, the Obama campaign. If you, people remember, retired General William Oldham said of Bush's invasion of Iraq that it was the greatest strategic disaster in the history of American military policy. So you have an establishment that needed somebody to come in and save the mess, which is basically what Obama tried to do over the first four years. Bail out the banks, bail out the corporations, restore profitability of American capitalism, and then secondly, try and salvage the disastrous occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan in the interests of U.S. imperial domination in those strategic regions of the Middle East and Central Asia. But, you know, much different than Bush, because Obama's articulate as opposed to Bush. In Obama's case, he nevertheless suffered major setbacks in Iraq. They were not able to extend the occupation indefinitely with five enduring military bases, which had been their plan. And so they lost ground because they couldn't extend the occupation. And then on top of that, you had the rebellion against the system, the Arab Spring, beginning in Tunisia, Egypt, spreading to Syria, Libya, Bahrain, every corner of the Middle East and North Africa, protesting principally against dictatorships that the U.S. has been allied with. So the U.S. military situation and economic situation in the Middle East got further destabilized. I forgot to time myself. Well, I'm doing okay, I think. I've only been going 7 minutes. I'm okay? All right.
You're in charge. You get it.
Oh, but that's cheating. I can't. That's cheating. So clearly, the Obama administration's attempt to rehab U.S. imperial positions in the Middle East has suffered continuing threats. And in Afghanistan, he basically copied Bush's surge in Iraq and applied it to Afghanistan. Not only Afghanistan, but extending it to this massive drone war all throughout Pakistan, which has destabilized Pakistan and killed scores of innocent civilians, blowing up wedding parties, massacring innocent civilians in their homes. I'm sure Soraya will talk a lot more about this. So in other words, the U.S. military position is still in a profound imperial crisis. And the other thing that Obama was brought in to do is solve the economic crisis. We are now in a long slump. It continues to limp along. Conditions have not improved whatsoever for regular people. The banks and corporations are sitting on record profits, but they're not investing it. They're just sitting on hordes of cash. Actually, the banks in New York City for the first time are charging corporations to store their money because they don't have anything to do with the money, so they're charging rent for storing the tons of dollars that the corporations have. But we are suffering massive unemployment, loss of our houses, our pensions, and all the poverty that's erupted all across the United States. So in this situation of an ongoing imperial crisis and economic crisis, the Obama administration has decided to reorient the strategy of American imperial power, mainly because while the U.S. has been suffering through this crisis, China, in particular, has continued to boom, expand its military, increase its political relations with countries that had used to be in the U.S. orbit, Africa, Latin America, all sorts of countries all around the world. So the U.S. has been losing ground because of this crisis, while China and its tributaries have actually been positioning themselves for a greater position of strength. That's what's behind Obama's announcement of the pivot to Asia. It's really all about China, as I will talk about. The initial announcement was presented as somehow an anti-war thing, that we're going to have to be cutting the Pentagon budget and blah, blah, blah. Actually, as Obama even said when he announced it at the Pentagon, after 10 years of actually just slowing the rate of growth of the U.S. military budget, it will be larger than the Bush administration's highest military budget. So this is not budget cutting. That's a smokescreen. What's really going on is shifting the priorities to deal with the two principal areas of American imperial crisis. That is China and Asia, and the second is in the Middle East. So this is an aggressive move on the part of the Obama administration to reorient American imperialism. And their main target in Asia is China, because China is now the biggest exporter in the world, that's just replaced the United States in the last year as the number one manufacturing power on the planet. It has the second largest military budget, and it has got all sorts of economic and political relations with countries like Brazil, who had used to be closely allied with the United States. Now Brazil's main export partner and import partner is China. So the U.S. is losing ground. So their strategy is, on the part of the Obama administration, we have to move from engagement with China to containment of China as a potential major imperial rival in the 21st century. So the Obama administration has laid out three prongs for their new strategy against China. The first one is economic. They've announced a NAFTA on steroids for Asia called the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, which is started with nine Asian countries, including the United States, ironically, the Asian power, the United States, and it excludes China. So they're trying to build a trade bloc that reorients the Asian economies on the U.S. and excludes China. The second thing that the U.S. is doing is a massive increase in the basing of U.S. troops and materiel throughout the Asian theater. As we know, they've just launched the new military base in Darwin, Australia, to deploy 2,500 U.S. Marines. They've escalated the number of U.S. naval ships that are going to be patrolling the South China Sea, a strategic interest of China and the U.S., the main transshipment route for US, Chinese commercial shipping, as well as oil exploration in the region. And they're solidifying the basing relations that they already have, as Anne will talk about, with all sorts of Asian countries. And then the other thing that they're doing is trying to use every political mechanism to split Asian countries away from China. So they, in particular, like Vietnam. Vietnam, they're creating all sorts of not only economic but political relationships and presenting the United States as an ally of Vietnam. If you can imagine the historical Orwellian world that we've entered, that the U.S. is suddenly an ally of the country that it bombed to smithereens in the 60s and 70s, but it's saying, we are your friend against China, who's a traditional imperial dominator of Vietnam and in Asia. So they're cultivating relationships politically to split them away and saying that the big brother of the United States is really going to defend your interests. So there's an elaborate series of political machinations that the U.S. is doing in the region. So that's what the U.S. is doing in Asia. In the Middle East, we know what they're doing. The main goal that they had, if you go back to the Bush administration, was regime change throughout the region. Begin with Iraq, then Syria, then Iran, to impose puppet governments that would open up the area to U.S. multinational oil corporations so that the U.S. could dominate the oil supplies. That hasn't worked. So who's the beneficiary of the U.S. failed war in Iraq? Is Iran. So the next stop, unsurprisingly, is Iran. And the whole smokescreen has been that Iran has this terrifying nuclear program, blah, 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 blah. Who's the only power that's used nuclear weapons? The United States. Who's got the majority of the nuclear weapons on the planet? No, nobody's got nuclear weapons on our panel. In the planet is the United States. So they're using the smokescreen of Iran developing nuclear weapons to really restore American power within the Middle East. So they're cultivating allies with all the Sunni regimes and using Israel to try and contain Iran, if not launch a war. We don't know what's going to happen. I think, in particular, the Netanyahu government in Israel is a wild card in the situation. The second thing they're doing is trying to hijack the Arab Spring, which is the biggest threat from below by the people of the Middle East and North Africa to the string of U.S.-supported dictatorships throughout the region. So we've already seen it in Libya, how they have hijacked a revolution and then used NATO to launch a massive war to contain the threat of the revolution from below. They're trying to do the same thing with Syria, which is an ally of Iran. So they're still going after the regime change in Syria. And to deal with the loss of the bases they hoped that they were going to get in Iraq, they now have an increased deployment of U.S. Navy all throughout the region, and they're bolstering the military bases that they already have in the region. And the final thing is they're so committed to this, back to the question of China, because whoever controls the oil, of the Middle East controls the Chinese economy, which is totally dependent on Middle Eastern oil. I let Soraya talk about what the situation and strategy in Afghanistan is after Obama's announcement of the so-called withdrawal in 2 years and the actual extension of the war until 2024. I'll let her talk about that. So I'll just conclude by saying that Obama is as committed to American imperial power as the Bush administration was. It has a new strategy to deal with a major potential imperial rival in the form of China. And if we want to stop the trajectory towards war in our world, we have to build an independent anti-war movement that no matter who is in office, a Republican or a Democrat, we stick to our principles of opposing U.S. imperialism in all cases, whether it's a kind face in the form of Obama or a nightmarish face in the form of, what's the unforgettable Mormon, what's his name? Romney, who's running for president. No matter who's in office, we stick to our principles. And I'll say the final thing, we are going to have to create a dynamic of international cross-border solidarity, because our international working-class movement is going to be divided along lines of nation. In the United States, they're going to whip up China bashing to justify what they're doing with China, and in China, they're going to whip up anti-Americanism, and we have to unite across borders, you know, among the people of the world so that we can live in a world where there's no war, there's peace, democracy, and an economy run in the interests of the majority. So I'll turn it over to you, to Anne Wright.
That was a tour de force of Americans' actions around the world, and quite an extraordinary, well, an excellent analysis of what's going on. Thank you, Ashley. And in particular on the Asia and the Pacific scene, I live in Hawaii. That's where I don't stay there often, but that's where my stuff lives, and I wish I had time to stay there longer, because the issues that come out of Hawaii are very, very important ones as a colony of the United States, of still an occupied nation by the United States. It's the headquarters of the U.S. Pacific Command, the largest U.S. military command in the world, is located in Hawaii, and it covers all, you know, the Asian and Pacific regions. And as we have heard from Ashley's analysis of this, the increase in the U.S. Focus on what's going on in Asia particularly is predictable. Mm-hmm. America always needs an enemy. And by golly, the Chinese are the ones we're going after now. I mean, even though they're the ones that control our debt, they've purchased our debt, or they've received the debt, as Ashley said, the largest exporter in the world, and America would be without many, many things very quickly if all of those huge container ships stopped moving from China into the United States. But it is, I mean, we as a country seem to need, we need an enemy. That's the way we focus on things, or that's the way our governments tell us as the people we have to focus. So now it's China's turn again. And we can see that very quickly things are starting to move. I mean, if you want to think about where all that massive equipment that has been in the Middle East by the United States over the last 10 years, where is it going to be moving? It'll be moving to pre-positioned places in the Pacific. In fact, there are already specific places already designated. We have equipment we know that's being transferred, the drones that you mentioned, the killer assassin drones in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia. We already have drone bases now in Asia. We have a drone base in the Philippines that's working with the Philippine military, you know, the military that kicked us out in the 1990s. We already have drones that are in there going after terrorist group, the Abbasiyef group there. We have a drone base agreement now with Australia on the Cocos Islands. It'll be a place where we'll be using drones. We have drones that are now going to be computerized drones that'll be flown from U.S. aircraft carriers, and they will be you don't really need a human involved at all. Once the computer code goes into it, it takes off by itself. It goes to do whatever it wants to do and comes back and lands on the aircraft carrier by itself. No human intervention needed, thank you very much. If I were the captain of that aircraft carrier, I would say, thank you very much. I don't want this thing on my ship. I mean, the automation, the computerization, the robotness of U.S. warfare now is incredible. What is going on now? And China will be the recipient of this, as it was, interestingly enough, during the Vietnam War. The first time drones were actually used over China during the Vietnam War, surveillance drones that they shot down. Mm-hmm. The circle is coming back around to the U.S. Look at Asia as we did back in the 1960s and 1970s with the Vietnam War. We can see other places besides just Australia, which is just starting out on the as being one of the linchpins, really, of the U.S. foreign policy and military policy for the next decade. And we should anticipate that all of the good Australians will start having massive protests down there about what they're seeing happening to their country, as U.S. Marines will be stationed in their country for the very first time. We see in other places in Asia, where the U.S. has had bases for the last 50 years. I mean, South Korea littered with American bases, although there's been a slow drawdown in the numbers of people that are Americans that are in Korea and a consolidation of the bases. Yet now we see that there's a new base on the pristine island of Jeju Island, one of the islands south of the mainland of South Korea, of an island that's never had a military installation on it in its whole history, now becomes the site of a naval base that will house part of the U.S. missile defense system, the Aegis missile defense system, Aegis missiles that will be mounted on South Korean naval destroyers, mm-hmm. but a place that U.S., the increase in the U.S. Armada for the Pacific will be able to home port. Just another little poke in the eye of the Chinese saying, we're coming closer, we're coming closer. We're just 150 miles, a little bit closer onto the mainland of China. And the Chinese are already reacting to this. I mean, they're reacting to the propaganda that the administration has put out about the dangers of the largest army in the world, the dangers of the second largest military budget in the world. Of course, it's only, one-third as much as what America spends, but it's still the second largest military budget in the world. And so the Obama administration is using this to hype up our concerns, our American concerns about what China really, what its motives are. And the Chinese are responding to this. They have built their very first aircraft carrier. Mm-hmm. Of course, that's drove a stake in the heart of the Obama administration. You know, that's the indication that China is moving out aggressively. And how many aircraft carriers does the U.S. have? I think it's 14. Yeah, but China, the largest land population or the largest population in the world, and it cannot have an aircraft carrier. You know, we had some people that went to Jeju Island to stand with the people of South Korea who say this naval base that's being built in a World Heritage ecosystem place, and the South Korean activists have been protesting this for the last 3 years. In solidarity, we've had a variety of people who have gone over there. I was there last August to be with the activists as they got their heads clobbered the week that I was there, and all sorts of people thrown in jail. Well, we had a group of Veterans for Peace, three Veterans for Peace, made a very public show. They were going over in solidarity. Well, the South Koreans, of course, read the internet too, and they saw the little blurbs online saying we had three Vets for Peace that are going over to stand in solidarity. So they were met at the immigration office on Jeju Island with their face, the picture of them looking back at them from the immigration booth. They were immediately detained and deported from Jeju Island back to where they came from, which was Shanghai, China. So when they got back to Shanghai, they went up, you know, they had to make their arrangements to come back to the United States. They had to change the ticket, and they went over to the, you know, ticket guy and or gal and said, you know, we got to change it. We've been sent back. And the guy went, oh, it's going to cost you about $1,000 or so, you know, to change this. And they went, yeah, but you know why we had to change it? Because we went over in support of the people of South Korea that don't want that naval base. It's going to be right in your face, and your own government has said, we don't want that. I mean, we know why the South Koreans are doing it. It's because the U.S. wants this done. And the guy at the ticket booth went, oh, yeah, that's right. Free change of ticket. Thank you for doing what you're doing. You know, we've got in Japan, another place where the U.S. has had a multitude of Navy bases and Air Force bases, and down on the island of Okinawa, Marine bases out the gazoo, and citizen activism saying, we don't want the Americans there. It's time for that you leave Okinawa. And it has worked. There's 10,000 Marines that have to leave Okinawa. And where they're going to go? Well, at first it was Guam. Guam, one of the, you know, American colonies, called a territory now. Guam that was going to be forced to receive these 10,000, plus it was going to take another 30,000 people to support the 10,000 Marines. So they were going to end up increasing the population of the island by a fourth with this military redeployment into Guam. Well, the people of Guam started saying, now, wait a minute, we don't want this. This is where you want to put all these people. You're going to be destroying pristine areas, da-da-da-da-da. And they raised a ruckus, too. So it looks like the Marines now are not going to go to Guam, and the people of Hawaii are going, uh-uh, if you're moving them out, just sail them right on past Hawaii and put them on the mainland of the United States, because we don't want them either. So you've got all sorts of activism that's going on. You've got in the Philippines that the U.S. has, after it was kicked out in the 90s, it now has another little agreement. And if you were in our workshop yesterday, Bernadette gave a very clear explanation of all this, the efforts being made by the U.S. government to open up the Philippines again. And in fact, we do have special forces. About 600 special forces that are in the Philippines right now that are working down in Mindanao to get rid of, you know, the insurgent threat in the Philippines, and not to say that they're, I mean, the group Abbas IF has certainly done some dastardly deeds, but it's an issue for the Philippines, the government of the Philippines, not for the U.S. government. In my opinion, however, of course, the U.S. government says, nope, it's an issue. It's a part of the worldwide war on terror, and we will send in not only our own special forces, but we'll also send in our technical equipment to include drones. So we now have a U.S. drone base on the island of Mindanao. In Hawaii, we continue to have a massive military presence, giant military bases, one for each of the services on the island of Oahu, and also on the largest island of the Hawaiian chain, on the Big Island, Pu'akaloa, which is a huge training base between the two volcanoes in Hawaii, on sacred ground of the Hawaiians. So, and that is being expanded because of the pivot to the Obama pivot to Asia and the Pacific. So there's a lot that's happening in the Pacific, and, you know, get ready. It's America on the move again as it makes its empire throughout the world. Thank you.
You're up, Sarai.
All right. Well, this is actually my first workshop, and I don't know if there's much I can say about U.S. politics in Afghanistan that most of you here don't already know, so I'm going to try to keep mine a little bit brief. If you actually look at the White House website right now, they are describing the strategic partnership agreement as the beginning of the end of the war in Afghanistan. While many people, and pretty much every Afghan I know, has been calling it the beginning of a permanent U.S. Military presence in Afghanistan. They've extended it numerous times already in the past. They will do it again. Our Prime Minister, Harper, had the audacity to announce the last one on Remembrance Day. Yeah. So as a puppet leader for the U.S., Karzai, of course, happily signed the deal. He does depend on their protection to survive in the country. And so...
That's not
oh, it doesn't even... Okay. I'll speak up. So Karzai depends on the protection of the U.S., and so he will protect U.S. interests. I'm not sure if many of you had seen the conference he did with Karzai, but to quote Obama, he said they're seeking a future of justice, peace, security, and opportunity. I'm going to say it one more time. Justice, peace, security, and opportunity. Justice, by who? Where warlords represent the NATO-backed Afghan government. Warlords responsible for some of the most heinous crimes committed during the Civil War, such as rape, looting, and mass killings against the civilian population. Peace, with what? The militarization of an already war-ravaged country. Security, how? When insurgents are currently able to freely target and attack so-called green zones against foreign embassies, NATO bases, and even government buildings. Opportunity. For who? Corrupt politicians and NGOs that have already taken billions of dollars from the country, from the military contractors that continue to profit off wars, from corporations and governments that have their eyes set on extracting natural resources. I could go on. Everything he said and continues to say is the exact opposite of the ground realities. He also went on to say he respects Afghanistan's sovereignty. As long as they are in Afghanistan, it will be seen as an occupation. I'm not even going to bother to address his stance on Al-Qaeda or bin Laden because these figures are and have been irrelevant to the war and, in my personal opinion, laughable. What we have seen in the last 10 years in Afghanistan is a rise in insecurity, a rise in violence, a rise in civilian deaths, poverty, corruption. Again, I could go on. However, what Afghanistan and its people need is a refocus on its priorities, not so different from the demands of ordinary people here in Chicago and among activists and Occupy and so on. Things like healthcare, education, job opportunities, restorative justice and reparations, community-based sustainable development. Most of all, and this is crucial because, well, what's the big fear when NATO-led troops leave Afghanistan? Civil war. There must be more efforts made for peace negotiations and reconciliation with every group inside Afghanistan, no exclusions. So I'm going to end it with this. Last September, the chief of Afghanistan's peace council, Rabbani, was killed. Yesterday, a senior Afghan peace negotiator in Afghanistan's High Peace Council, who's also a former Taliban minister, his name is Arsala Rahmani, he was also killed. That's about it.
Thanks, Soraya.
Thanks.
So I will keep a stack if people raise their hand. Some people I know, others I don't. And we'll take a round, and then we'll have responses from the panel. And when Anne Wright gets back in, let me just keep your hands up. Like some people I don't know. Okay. Keep track of you by an article of your clothing. Okay, I got you. And then I got you, Joe. All right, we'll begin with the Sony man in the front. Go ahead. And try and keep it like 3 minutes. Yeah.
I have one for Anne and one for you. The question for you is, how is the CIA's increase in opium production and export affecting the Afghan people?
Oh, we'll just let a few comments and then,
sure.
Is that all right? Okay, I'll hear in the green.
Ashley, this is for you. A lot of what you said made perfect sense to me, but it sounded to me like you were implying that in Libya and in Syria, these were homegrown revolutions. And not everybody shares that view. I can comment on that.
And then black shirt.
Maybe that's what you're saying all along, and I just began to share. And saying that the purpose of making the Chinese a target is just to get it's really a reciprocal arrangement. Powerful interest in China as well as powerful interest in the United States to label the Chinese as a target and get the vice versa if the Chinese respond with upping the war rhetoric against the United States if that would.
Joe?
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment or a question. I think it's important to think about what we're doing next Sunday. We're protesting NATO. The anti-war movement in the United States typically protests the U.S. government and not NATO. There's a distinction there. I believe that the reason that more and more of the United States wants to do things in the name of NATO or in Iraq, the Coalition of the Willing, which really was a coalition, was because they are affected by the protests and the consciousness of the American people. And, you know, the majority, big majority now, is against the war in Afghanistan. However, this same thing has a dynamic with the drones, too. The big majority of this country are in support of drones. It's this idea that wars are okay. It's a children's idea in this country. Wars are okay if Americans don't die. And so in NATO, when we went to Libya, we used NATO, as we were afraid of what the anti-war movement can do. And I think when they came here with NATO and the G8, they didn't expect protests. And believe me, there's a large section of the anti-war movement in this country who will not be here on Saturday, on Sunday, does not want to protest here on Sunday. But the real anti-war movement will be here and is protesting. And I think it's an important thing that we have to start pointing out how they use these others to do proxy wars for the United States. And that the anti-war movement is here and on the stage and is going to protest them everywhere they can. I think the United States didn't expect the kind of protest that they are seeing around NATO. So it's a little bit of a shift in terms of the way they're doing things. And it's going to be important for us to start talking to people about the problems of war, not just when Americans die.
Thanks, Jeff. Soraya, do you want to respond to some of those questions? And then I'll respond.
People who killed the peace negotiators, one was a, for Rabbani, it was a suicide attack. For the former Taliban minister, it was an anonymous gunman. So I can't say. Also for as for opium, what I do know is that many of the farmers in Afghanistan, they actually depend on growing opium fields as a means of living. But what the U.S. military has been doing, like burning crops, aviary, chemical spraying, I'm not sure if you've heard of that. Actually, sometimes in fields that aren't even growing poppies, it's had devastating effects on these poor farmers. But there is an argument that it should be made legal to use for medicinal purposes, which I actually do think would be more helpful, but that's not what they're doing. What's that? Oh, you can't
hear
me? Sorry.
I did have one more question that popped into my head.
It's been disastrous for the poor farmers. Okay.
Do you think that the Afghan people should pursue war crime charges against the Bush and Obama administration?
Of course. Absolutely, yes.
I mean,
they're war criminals. Because they're war criminals, yes.
Yeah, I mean,
I do.
It's not his question, but his job.
Yeah, that's great. All right, so I had a few questions that were posed to me. First, about the Arab Spring, Libya, and Syria. I think we have to look in the whole region of North Africa and the Middle East. And in all of those countries, you have a situation of autocratic governments, both monarchies and straight-up dictatorships, that rule over the population. Some of those dictatorships are allied with the United States. Some of them have been historic antagonists. And some have vacillated between being an opponent and an ally. And in those situations, the mass of the population despise their governments, whether they're allied with the United States or not. An example of Libya, Gaddafi used to be an antagonist of the United States, then became a dear friend, became the jailer of North Africans who were being prevented from fleeing to Italy for jobs. Then he started cutting the social welfare safety net, started dividing and conquering the tribes of Libya, and he was utterly despised in the country and in the region. So you have a legitimate protest movement that develops, inspired by the uprisings in Egypt and in Tunisia, just like you have throughout the entire region. And the U.S. response to that was to say, okay, Gaddafi, who's been our friend, buddy-buddy with the Bush administration, buddy-buddy with the Obama administration, is suddenly an enemy, so that the U.S. can get into the region and hijack a legitimate revolution, impose allies in the leadership of the revolution to behead the threat of it spreading and getting outside of the U.S. control, so the U.S. can then present itself as a friend of the Arab Spring, which it's terrified of. The same dynamic is playing out in Syria. So I think the position of anti-war activists is ABCs. We're against U.S. intervention, full stop, in any form, whatever it is. And at the same time, we're in solidarity with the legitimate fight for the liberation of the people in every country, no matter that whether that government is allied to the United States or whether it's an opponent of the United States. Because no matter what, these are governments of the 1%, not of the 99%. We're for a society run by the 99% in each and every country all around the world. That's in the spirit of Occupy, international solidarity from below. The China-U.S. relationship is one of the most peculiar things in the history of world imperialism, when you think about it. Remember who cut the deal with Mao was Nixon going to China. So Nixon and Mao became bosom buddies. And the idea was, we're going to have an alliance against Russia. And so the U.S. then used that relationship to make China an export processing zone of U.S. multinationals, especially in the 1980s and into the 1990s and 2000s. However, if you want to run the planet and you don't have a manufacturing base that undergirds that, you're going to have a problem. And so China very smartly said, we're going to pair all the manufacturing that comes from an American corporation with a Chinese corporation to develop our own independent ability to produce and therefore accumulate global power. So China has migrated from an ally, an export processing zone, to a potential threat. And so you've got the Obama administration explicitly saying, we need to reshore American manufacturing. That is, start reindustrializing American society so that any of us in this room, so that the 1% in American capitalism can run American capitalism without having this compromising relationship to a rising imperial power. So you're seeing a migration from, you know, an ally to a potential imperial rival. And so that means that the pivot to Asia is fundamentally about who's going to dominate the world economy. Is it going to be China and its corporations, both private and state-owned, or is it going to be American multinationals? And so you're going to see this dynamic play out over the coming years. Right now, they're very engaged economically. They're very engaged, but there's an increasing separation. There are starting to be American manufacturers that are coming back to the United States because the cost of American labor has been driven down so low that when you subtract the transportation costs from China to the United States, American wages are becoming competitive with the Chinese wage. So that's part of the global race to the bottom. And the biggest worry right now, like I was just hearing at this Caterpillar strike in Joliet, Illinois, that the Caterpillar workers were making anti-Chinese arguments because a lot of there's a fear that the plant will go to China for cheap labor. That is going to be an argument that we're going to hear that's going to be very dangerous for our labor movement, so that we've got to keep arguing in the United States that Chinese workers are on our side. Chinese workers, if they raise their wages and benefits, that's good for us. If we raise our wages and benefits, that's good for us. So that we start breaking down the kind of nationalist rhetoric that we're going to hear from the Obama administration about China, that the Chinese regime is going to use against the United States, and the response has got to be just like all around the Middle East and our relationship to the uprising in the Arab Spring, is solidarity across borders between people in the United States, workers in the United States, and workers in China, because we are the 99%, and those governments in both countries here and in China represent the 1%. And for me, I just think that it's part of what capitalism does. You have capitalist governments that want to jockey for a bigger slice of the world pie, and so they use militaries to enforce the rule of the 1%, their own 1% against other 1%, and that's why it's a systemic problem. And in the end, we've got to go more than just ending the wars. We've got to rip up the roots of this problem in the system that we live under. So my 2 cents on that. Oh, and yeah, whatever. Okay, other people.
I come from a foreign country. Doesn't mean I heard a lot of friends in my Philippines, by Japan or something. It doesn't mean the anti-American military over there. Military now, they're sending out a lot of military people. I cannot say they are uneducated. It's not really realistic. They want American, like Philippines, Malaysia, Indonesia, when I travel over there. They hate American war. They send a whole bunch of bomb over there.
Mm-hmm.
Positive bomb, and no sentiment to help local people. If you send some educated people using the military money, open a school for the kid, hospital, and help them. You send a whole bunch of bomb over there and terrorize it, open more bomb, more positive. Who's going to like you?
Yeah.
The people send a whole bunch of the bomb city down over there, nobody likes you.
Mm-hmm.
They have to change in the 70% of the people.
Other comments, questions? Oh, sorry, I didn't see you.
It's okay. I appreciate your talk, and I like to apologize that you made. One thing I didn't hear, and I don't hear hardly any about, is Bahrain. And I feel like they really kind of got short in the stick when it comes to the Arab Spring.
Mm-hmm.
It's happening at the exact same
time.
And it was completely ignored and blacked out by everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, I don't know what the level of support other than just supporting ignoring it from the U.S. government was, but I mean, there was use of, like, large paramilitary forces that were, like...
Big time.
That were unidentified, that were just looking like civilians, and some of them were killed in neighborhoods where they were resisted and were part of Saudi military.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you could just mention something about that.
Other... Yeah. Over here.
I have a question for you.
Soraya.
Yes.
Yeah. It's okay.
What do you think the U.S. military government should do in Afghanistan?
Whatever they do, it should not involve violence, bombs, tanks, drones, weapons of any kind.
So they should leave?
Militarily, yes. All foreign, I believe, all foreign military must withdraw from Afghanistan immediately.
I'll call myself, and then somebody had a question for Anne. If you could restate it, so go ahead, restate it.
You had mentioned Al-Saeed. Are they one of the so-called terrorist organizations that's funded by the U.S. intelligence apparatus as well?
The Abu Sayyaf group. Well, I don't know. The U.S. government doesn't say that it funds it. It has a long history in the Philippines. Although, as we know, never to be surprised at where the devious minds of U.S. government employees, of which I was part, full disclosure, for a long time.
Well, that's why I know that most terrorist organizations funded by either U.S. or British intelligence apparatuses. That's why I thought of that question.
Yeah. Well, the U.S. has had it on the Abu Sayyaf group on its list of terrorists for quite a long period of time. I believe it was the group that was alleged to have been the group that was going to try to blow up 11 airliners in one day that were coming across the Pacific. Remember that? That was before 9/11 even. So there's a bit of a history with that group, and it's been solidly in the southern island of Mindanao in the Philippines, which has been a place where Filipinos who reject the U.S. Imperialism on their own country for, 60 years, there was already an anti-imperialist movement in Mindanao before the group called Abu Sayyaf started up. But it's a place where dissent from the politics of the country has been very strong.
Please. Actually, you go to the Philippines and any other place, you talk to the people, local people. They didn't hate American, Indonesia people, they have not hated Americans. They hate American, they say, we send the corporation, we send out the people, it's not how the local people.
Mm-hmm.
And how the government. If you send even though you're a soldier and anything used to be educated or military personnel can open up and help the local people. And people will hate you because they need the job anyway. They need your stronger country to go to help when the poor people cannot. You go to help the government to prosecute the local people. And they're gonna hate you, they don't want you to be over there. You know, if you say you turn around to help the local people, do all this stuff, and be true about that, and people they will anything they will be welcome you. You know, you should be really welcome you turn to that place and nobody gonna talk to you at all. You know.
Other
that's just what you were saying.
Other people want to get on the stack. Other questions? I'll just respond to a couple of things to questions, issues on the floor. I think, you know, one of the things that Malalai Joya says over and over and over again about Afghanistan and what the U.S. should do, she always says no nation can free another nation, that only the people in that nation can free themselves from an autocratic government or from a foreign occupation. And I think I completely agree with Soraya that the U.S. should get out right now, and what they should do is pay reparations for the destruction of the country for the last 30, 40 years of what the U.S. has tortured this country with war, instigating the, you know, triggering the Russian invasion and occupation, what was absolutely catastrophic for the Afghan people, and then backing all sorts of warlords in the post-Russian invasion situation to then playing footsie with the Taliban at various points and then invading and occupying the country all over again. So the U.S., the main thing it can do is pay war reparations to the country, and then the Afghan people can decide how they want to rebuild their society. And people like Soraya and the Afghan population in Afghanistan itself should be the ones that make those decisions, not Americans. And I think it's a point that the great American socialist John Reed made long ago. He said, Uncle Sam never gives you something for nothing. He always comes with a stack of hay in one hand and a whip in the other. And what you pay for is blood, sweat, and tears when the U.S. comes. Because the American 1%, they don't care about the 99% here in the United States. The 1% that runs the American foreign policy and the U.S. policies in these occupations, they don't care about the 99% of those kind of societies. So our responsibility is to protest our government and force war reparations to Iraq, to Afghanistan, to the many other countries, and then the people of those countries will have the resources that the U.S. has robbed from these societies to rebuild their societies the way they see fit. And then on the question of Bahrain, I think, you know, I try to do too much in a tiny amount of time, but Bahrain exposes the hypocrisy of the U.S. on the Arab Spring like no other country in the region of the Middle East. Because as we know, you had a similar legitimate uprising of the majority of Bahrain against their autocratic state. And the U.S., while it was saying, oh, I suddenly have discovered democracy and justice in the Middle East after supporting injustice and autocracy and occupation for decades, suddenly is on the side of the Arab Spring, except in Bahrain. Why? Because the Fifth Fleet is based there, that serves at the dispensation of the autocracy, and that Saudi Arabia, which the U.S. backs, invaded the country to put down the uprising because the Bahrain government doesn't have a military force large enough to repress the population. And so while the U.S. is embracing democracy in Libya, supposedly, by bombs from the air, which is a bizarre idea, democracy brought to you by bombs, it is exposed in its hypocrisy of backing and silencing the story of the repression, the bloody repression of the legitimate uprising in Bahrain. And I think it's something that we have to pound home, because the big trick that the U.S. is using right now is saying that our military, not our military, their military, can intervene in the world for humanitarian purposes, and that's a lie. And every chance we have to expose that lie and say, you know, what John Reed said long ago, they never give you something for nothing. They always come with a whip in their hand to get what they want, which is resources, labor markets, whatever, what geopolitical power, that's what drives U.S. government behavior and its military. Ann, go ahead.
If I could just add something on Bahrain, citizens of Bahrain have been just so strong, so brave, so courageous to be standing out there facing off, facing down this U.S. Organized and trained Bahraini police force. You know, the former head of the NYPD is now in Bahrain. He's been the head of their police force. He's giving them the training. If you want to see what goes on in Bahrain, all you have to do is look at New York and the heads that have been beaten up there. But the Bahraini activist group sent out an appeal about 2 months ago saying we're going to really ramp up all of these protests again, and we'd like to have some international help on this. So a small appeal went out, and it wasn't publicized at all because we knew what was going to happen. Same thing that happened to Veterans for Peace trying to get into Jeju Island. If you publicize it, you know, people will be watching, and they won't even let you in the country. So we were able to get 13 people into the country before they finally figured out what was going on and then stopped the next 5 people coming in. But people like Huwaida Arif, Palestinian-American, a human rights lawyer, she and another human rights lawyer got in. Medea Benjamin got in. Tig Berry, who's here right now, got in. Billy Kelly, Veterans for Peace, got in. So they were there to be stand in solidarity with, as Medea, who is fearless. I mean, she stood up toe-to-toe, nose-to-nose with a heck of a lot of people, and she said, I was scared with what these Bahraini women were doing. They were going out, and you can see the pictures on the internet. I mean, these women are getting right in the face of the police. And then as the tear gas canisters were blown right at them, you know, some of them were taken down by it. But it is amazing what the activists are doing in some of these countries, which should give us, I mean, for us in America not to be standing up when we see all of these other courageous, brave people all around the world that are standing up. It is so important, as Malalaya Joy has said in her message, it's so important that we're there. Not that we're not asking for violence. We don't want violence at all. That we know what the forces are against us. And we are, I think, I'm not psychologically prepared for tear gas to be coming at me, but boy, I'll tell you, if we don't stand up there, if we don't face them down, we're just seeding any hope at ever changing these systems. So I hope we do get lots and lots of people out here because on Sunday, because the world will be there in solidarity with us.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
I had a question for Sarai.
Sure.
It's probably naive, but I do genuinely hope that all the occupiers can be removed from your country as soon as possible. And since part of this summit, I think, is for the people to try to imagine a different world, an alternative to the one that's being imposed by NATO and other groups, could you share a little bit about what your vision of what might be the Afghan people might be able to do in their own country? Of these occupiers, what the first steps might be, good and bad?
Well, one of them I had mentioned was the peace negotiations and also just community-based efforts. I'm not sure if any of you have here, who raised of hands, who's heard of the Afghan Youth Peace Volunteers?
Yeah.
Okay, good. There were some people. listen to the message of just ordinary Afghans like them who, first of all, they're originally from northern Afghanistan. When you think Afghanistan war and resistance to the war, you think southern Afghanistan and ethnic Pashtuns. These guys, these kids, students, are in northern Afghanistan. They're from northern Afghanistan, and they're ethnic Hazaras, Tajiks, who are, you know, I mean, it's amazing to think. I would have never imagined that one of the most vocally outspoken Afghans inside Afghanistan against the NATO occupation and war would be from the north among non-Pashtuns, and they're traveling throughout the country meeting with other Afghans from other ethnic backgrounds, from other walks of life, and having these meetings saying, okay, what can we do to make Afghanistan a better place? These are just Afghan youth doing it on their own. Why would they sit and wait for when you hear about the Afghanistan war, who's making all the decisions, who's talking about it? You have the corrupt politicians, you have the NATO military leaders, you have, you know, the media. Very rarely do you ever hear from the voice of just regular Afghans. So I would like to see more the Afghan people themselves take control and have their voices heard. And they do have a Global Days of Listening to Afghans. It's actually the website is globaldaysoflistening.org, I believe. And you can every month on the 21st. I do it through Skype. You listen to these young Afghan kids, and they talk to young people from all over the world, and they share war stories from people from Congo and Palestine and Iraq, and it's phenomenal. So I think it should be community-based.
If I could just mention that, you know, the removal of international military forces, we're always told, well, you know, everything will just go to hell in a handbasket. I mean, the Afghans will just, it's just, it will be horrible. We have to be there to save Afghanistan from itself. And, you know, it's the same story that's used in every military intervention and occupation, that if we get out, if the U.S. gets out or whatever, that no one can handle anything, and we've got to do it by military operations rather than by discussions and things like that. So, you know, don't be deluded. That's what makes the money for the military-industrial complex, to continue these wars. That's what gets generals promoted. There's a whole interest group that wants wars to continue. That said, in my opinion, it will not be easy for the Afghans after the occupiers leave. I mean, there are tremendously difficult forces within the country itself. The old warlords, the Mujahideen, the freedom fighters, now called the warlords or the militias. I mean, they gained their power from the United States, first furnishing them the weapons back to defeat the Soviets. And then they, and them fighting among themselves in the Civil War of Afghanistan. And these guys have been, you know, that many of them are part of the government now, so they've been part of the graft, greed, and corruption. They've gotten billions of dollars already. They've retrained their militias, re-equipped their militias by putting them into the Afghan army and the Afghan police forces. So they can recall them at any point to their warlord family. So it is not going to be an easy task in Afghanistan, but one would hope that the opportunity to reconcile the various forces that are within Afghanistan can be done without the loaded gun of the international community that is killing hundreds of people every single day. But it ain't going to be easy for the Afghans.
Other questions? Go ahead, Leah.
What you just said reminded me of what you hear politicians say all the time, that even the ones that say they want us to get out of Afghanistan, they use this term of, but we have to get out responsibly. And what the hell do you think that means to them? I mean, what does that mean, to get out responsibly? I mean, I just don't get what that's supposed to mean.
I think what they're talking about is that the policy of the U.S. has been to train a national army and a national police that is then that protects the central government. The central government that is, you know, in the beholding of the international community. And I think that's what they're talking about, of responsible thing. That's why we have to stay at least till the year 2014, that was the initial time, to train all of these security forces for Afghanistan. So the central government, which is alleged to be the most corrupt government in the world, with the exception probably of the U.S. government, and graft, greed, and corruption. But I think that's what their version of responsible stuff is.
I think it's just pure trickery. Let's just call it what this is, white man's burden stuff. That basically people in occupied countries can't take care of themselves, and so they need the benevolent savior in the form of the U.S. military to responsibly train their society. I mean, it is classic colonial rhetoric. And we should think deeper. What they mean by responsible withdrawal is unending occupation. Because if you look at what Obama and Bush wanted for Iraq, was 5 enduring bases after withdrawal. That's what they mean by withdrawal. 5 enduring bases forever in Iraq to be the policemen of the region, right? And what they want in Afghanistan is exactly the same. They want bases after 2014, after the end of the occupation, to have drone bases, military bases, to be the overlords of a quote-unquote independent Afghanistan. So responsible withdrawal actually means unending occupation and overlordship by the great white savior, quote-unquote, or in the case of Obama, it's not a white savior in that case, so I guess it's a different situation. But they're not serious about withdrawal. They want unending occupation, especially in Afghanistan, because it's not just about Afghanistan. Afghanistan is a big player in a regional squabble over who's going to control Central Asia, the strategic natural gas and oil reserves of the Caspian Sea, and the pipeline routes. Is it going to be Russia, China, or the U.S.? And so they are part of what in the 19th century was called the Great Game, which was Russia and Britain squabbling over Afghanistan for the division of all of Central Asia. The U.S. is involved in a new Great Game, an inter-imperial rivalry of who's going to control the oil, natural gas, resources, and the pipeline routes. And so they have geostrategic interests that are big time. And so they're not going to leave responsibly. They're going to stay irresponsibly in Afghanistan because that's their real aim.
Also, just to add to that, you keep in mind that they've also repackaged the mission a number of times now. They went in to fight Al-Qaeda, bin Laden, and then to promote, enforce democracy, fighting for women's rights, and now it's to train the Afghan soldiers. So, and they'll just probably continue doing that.
Exactly. You got a question?
Yeah, it's more of a comment, and I wanted to get your opinions on it. It's more about the tactics and the problems of our tactics as far as fighting this imperialism and the industrial complex. This is a quote from Aaron Hughes, an organizer for the NATO. 18 veterans every day commit suicide, 17% of service members in Afghanistan on psychotropic medication. My question is, or my comment is, when do we take these our fight to the recruiter's office and start standing outside the recruiter's office and saying we are not going to, we're at least going to voice our concern to these young people coming in to not do this because you're going to be in a mental health crisis, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And you're going to be murdering people. Mm-hmm. It seems so anti-patriotic, especially for here in America, but if there's no people to fly these drones or to be at these bases, then, that severely stops the war effort. And that's just a tactic that I think we need to get on right now. You know?
Over here.
I just think, I guess just quickly on that, if you look at what's been going on, I think especially in Afghanistan, it's been very kind of clear over the last, few months, how much quagmire really exists, not only with the occupation itself, but with the way in which veterans and soldiers within the military are being treated and therefore treating, for instance, like Afghans. Because you have to remember the underlying basis, not only of the justification to everyone in the U.S. about going to war, say, in Afghanistan or Iraq, which is like incredibly racist, you know, what other people have addressed, that was also how they sold it to soldiers, to be able to go in there to do the night raids, to do the drones, to do all these different things. But there's all of this going on. But I think that you're seeing the cracks in it. Because if you think about even the atrocities that have happened with,
Bales?
Yeah, Bales. Bales. Bales tried to refuse another tour because of mental health issues that he was cognizant of. And that the U.S. continually does that to not just people like Sergeant Bales, but to everyone in the military. That's a systematic thing. And so I think, really, the anti-war movement needs to be able to address like what the quote was talking about, which is the mental health epidemic within the military. But I also think it's about a much bigger thing, which is that it's a jobs crisis. It's a crisis not only for veterans, but for people that are thinking about the military. Now, I don't think people are thinking about the military right now so much because of, you know, they want to go to Afghanistan and fight. Yeah, I mean, that's not the reality. The reality is that it provides benefits for you. It's the only way that you may be able to go to college without going to $100,000 in debt in the future. That's the basis of it. And so I think being able to take up those questions is incredibly important. And then the last thing I'd say, which I think is something that's an incredibly important role that the movement can play, is bringing in Arabs and Muslims into the movement along with veterans to be able to have those conversations and be able to put forward, you know, a whole sort of analysis of it together. Because I think that's been something in the past that we haven't done a great job of. We're starting to now, but I think that's especially needed for a whole host of reasons. But I just think that it's a really bad problem for the U.S. right now that's going on within the military itself. But those economic questions especially have to be addressed in order
Yeah. I'm actually really glad you both mentioned that about shutting down recruiting centers and also veterans along with Muslims. I'm actually happy to say that I believe it was last month, Afghans for Peace, my colleagues who are based in the U.S., along with Iraq Veterans Against the War, marched for that reason. Mm-hmm. And they were able to shut down the U.S. military recruiting center that day as well. And I believe it was... California, Fremont. So if you want to search it. California, and I believe it was Fremont.
Well, there are quite a few organizations that are working on exactly what you're talking about, and sometimes it's the confrontations that Soraya just mentioned of going there and blocking them down. We've tried to block down the Marine Corps station in Berkeley, California. For God's sake, Berkeley has a Marine recruiter. We even went to the city council and had an all-night testimony thing about taking that Marine Center out of there. But there are groups that go into the high schools. And any time a recruiter comes in to a high school, they demand that somebody that is there to offer an alternative vision gets to come in. So you might check here. I know in the Chicago area there are groups that do go into the high schools to talk about these things and to make sure that parents know that their kids don't have to take that military entrance exam, which is given in every high school unless you opt out of it. So there are a lot of groups. One other aspect besides the suicide rate and all these things are, if you want to talk a kid out of joining the military, tell them the statistics on what the military does to each other. 1 in 3 women will be raped while they're in the military by their own fellow citizen, their own fellow soldiers. And the statistics are not clear at all, but of the 3,200 people that acknowledged and reported being sexually assaulted, raped in the military last year, 10% of those reporting being raped were men. So that is really the tip of the iceberg. So it is a predatory organization where violence, that you're trained to be violent toward other people, that violence comes back on people within the military as well as their families and in the communities that they return to after they get out.
I have a comment, and then I'm going to call on you in the striped shirt. I think this is part of the weakened imperial position that the U.S. is in, because the occupations and what it's done to the U.S. military personnel has been absolutely catastrophic. Obviously, we know the occupied population, you know, Iraq, they killed 1 million people, 5 million refugees, the utter destruction of Iraq's infrastructure over 20 years of warfare and occupation. But the Iraqi veterans... You're talking about high rates of unemployment, high rates of homelessness, not getting their benefits, being denied the medical coverage, and that means you've got a military that is not deployable in the same kind of way. They've maxed out the American military, and the disastrous wars and occupations have also brought back the Vietnam syndrome. That is the healthy idea that you don't want to go to war for the United States. We can call it the Iraq War syndrome. And that's where the question of drones that Joe brought up earlier is very important. They're trying to automate the conducting of war so they don't have the problem of the broken soldier and the unwilling soldier. So that's why our taking up the question of drone warfare and seeing how pernicious it is. Like, people should read Medea Benjamin's book on the new drone warfare. She's going to be speaking tomorrow night. She couldn't come because of death in her family for our People Summit, but she's flying in tomorrow, and she's going to be speaking on drone warfare, killing by remote control, tomorrow evening, Monday, May 14th. At 7 p.m. And where is this? The Heartland Cafe. We have flyers up here. But people should really take the question of drone warfare, because if you look at what they've done in Afghanistan and Pakistan, all over the world now, in Mexico they want drones. They really want to use this automated soldier, you know, robo-soldiers, robo-planes, to do a lot of the work that they've been having live human beings do. So, you know, I think we have to protest what's been done to the soldiers and also understand they have many tricks in their arsenal, and then they have many new political tricks in their arsenal to re-legitimize U.S. war and occupation. That's what Libya was really all about. And then this crazy Kony 2012 shenanigan that somehow the U.S. is going to liberate Africa after, you know, being the originators of the slave plantation. So it's like, you know, we have to be the people that cut through their new political tricks. Over there.
Yeah, actually, on that, I mean, I think that the Occupy movement is born. I don't think it's an accident that we have a movement of occupations in the U.S., right? Because I think that we're a direct descendant of the Arab Spring.
Mm-hmm.
It's important. important for us to see ourselves as not only the American occupiers, right, trying to take back our country, and the way that the media tries to frame it, right, like what
yeah.
we're about, right, we're trying to restore America and all this. We're actually like in the tradition of Tahrir Square, right? We're in the tradition of Bahrain, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we should acknowledge that. And we should actually embrace that fully, right? Because
mm-hmm.
there's so much racism in this country going on, and that's the way they justify this whole summit. You know, the idea that these generals, these war pigs, come to our city and enjoy the luxuries of Rahm Emanuel shutting down the city for them, right? That is all built on this sort of machine that is spread through the mainstream media, that it's okay to invade other countries,
mm-hmm.
it's okay to
mm-hmm.
spread democracy and freedom with machine guns and war. And the other thing I want to say is it's very important for our movement to actually take the time and hold conferences like this,
mm-hmm.
right? Where we can talk about what it means to live in the most disgusting imperialist country in the world, right? What it means to actually think about dismantling or ending the war, you know? Like we should be talking about how we ended the Vietnam War, right?
Yep.
And all of this is very important, right? Because if we just conceive of our movement as something that's sporadic and something that is in the framework of the free market, right? Of free market solutions to all of these problems, then we're you know? We have to think about what it means to fight imperialism, not only where it's in the front lines, right, but here at
mm-hmm.
home, right? The war is at home, right?
Yep.
It's a rich man's war, and it's pouring poor people's blood, right? And
yep.
That's the slogan we should set up.
All right, we're at... We're at time, so I'm just going to take in reverse order of what we spoke, or however.
And you go first, Sarai, you're next, and I'll back clean up. Any final comments?
Well, just, you know, call up. We've got a week before the big march. And a week, people can come in from any part of the United States, to include Alaska and Hawaii. You almost can swim from Hawaii to get here in a week. And we, I mean, what? But it, you know, it is so important that we really show the world what we're doing, what America is doing, what NATO is doing, and to build our numbers, to get people out here. And if, how many of you all are not from Chicago? Okay,
oh
so, yeah, look at this, already here. So you all don't really, you're not busy 24 hours a day, you don't have to go home to your family or whatever else, you're here to work 24 hours a day. I think, what we that are from out of town, I mean, there is a robust number of events that are already planned. Every single day there's something planned, but there are hours in that day that we can help get this huge city of Chicago mobilized. I mean, talk to the taxi drivers if you happen to take a taxi. Talk to the bus drivers. Talk to everyone. Leave a flyer. Try to get as many people out as we can on Sunday, because it really is. It's important that we make this stand right here in Chicago. I know Joe's had trouble getting people in. A bus was canceled that was coming from New York for this conference right here, and trying to get... go back to your communities to say, you know, things are happening here. We need you. We need you. We need to get buses going. And if organizations can pop for $1,000 to get another 60 people here on a bus to really pull, you know, get the money going here so that we can get a huge number of people out here on the streets of Chicago. Thank you.
I don't really have anything to add except, now that I have mentioned the Afghan Youth Peace Volunteers, I'll be reading a statement that they had wrote at the last plenary today. That's about
great.
It. Yeah.
I just want to riff off what the brother said about this being a part, that we are in the inheritors of Tahrir Square, because that was really brought home to me when I was in Wisconsin, when there was the rebellion against Scott Walker, when trade unionists and regular working class people were occupying the state headquarters. And it blew my mind when I was there, because it was happening at the same time as Tahrir Square. And what blew my mind was that American workers who probably, you know, whatever, 8 years ago supported the war in Afghanistan, were identifying not with Americans, but with people in Tahrir Square. And so they had placards that said, "Walk like an Egyptian, strike like an Egyptian, revolt like an Egyptian," and they renamed Scott Walker, the governor of Wosconsin, Scott Hosni Mubarak Walker. So talk about an incredible leap of consciousness from white Wisconsin cheeseheads who are identifying with rebels against an American ally who are Muslim and Arab. That's the potential that I think we need to see, that we've got to cultivate and build an international consciousness of the 99% against our respective 1% exploiters and oppressors in each and every country. And Chicago is ground zero for that consciousness that we have to build. So you think the NATO warmongers are coming to hatch their plans for global domination under the auspices of the United States, the Obama administration, in the city where Rahm Emanuel is carrying through the most vicious austerity measures against the working population of Chicago. So you have, in a nutshell, the whole problem with the world that's coming to Chicago. War and austerity combined together. And what we need to do is start building the movement against against their summit, and see this as a process of forging bonds across the borders of the world system, so that we can really fight for a global transformation, which is what's needed from Afghanistan to here in the United States. Oppose the war makers, oppose the austerity mongers, and build an international movement for peace, justice, and equality.